Hey, you kids, cut out that rack. Oh, it's not a rack. It's our theme music, and it's for the broadcast of Indie Week, the Independent, and it's read by John Federson, that's me, and a product of the North Carolina Reading Service for our blind and print-impaired listeners. Our issue dated today, December the 15th of 2023. Plenty of articles to get to today, so as soon as we can turn those pesky kids off the front lawn with their piano, we'll get going. First up, from Durham, facing rising costs, Durham Public Schools may delay some renovations. 8 public school construction projects were to be funded with money from 2022 Durham County bond referendum, but due to increased construction costs, only 4 will likely be undertaken before the end of next year, according to school officials. Construction of the new Murray Massenburg Elementary School and a design for a new Durham School of the Arts are underway, and renovations at Glenn Elementary will begin in early 2024. DPS Superintendent Pascal Mubenga said at a November 17th meeting of County Commissioners and Durham School Board, "Once we address DSA, Durham School of the Arts, Glenn, we are only going to have enough money to be able to tackle one more school, which is going to be Moorhead." He also predicted the school system may fall $7 to $10 million short on the Moorhead Elementary renovation project. The bond referendum included construction of a new Murray Massenburg Elementary and Durham School of Arts and listed comprehensive renovation of 6 other schools, but the predicted costs of each project have increased significantly, leaving questions about how the school system will fund anticipated renovations at Holt, Bethesda, Club Boulevard, and Mangum Elementary School. Mubenga's comments followed a presentation by Larry Johnson, Chief Operations Officer with Durham Public Schools. Johnson described the increased cost of the planned school construction and renovation projects. He attributed the rise in construction and renovation costs to labor shortages, increase in material commodity prices, supply chain issues, and the war in Ukraine. At the meeting, several community members voiced opposition to the DSA plans, which call for building a new school several miles north of the existing campus. That's for the School of the Arts. Construction is set to begin this summer. The speakers noted that constructing a new DSA will cost $240 million, more than half the amount voters approved in that referendum. Trinity Park resident Julia Boberly Brown said, "I believe also that a number of the stakeholders would view this idea of deferring maintenance of the elementary schools as neglect of them." John Hodges Koppel also criticized DSA plans. He's a retired planning director for Triangle J Council of Governments and said, "In short, there seems to be at least a $100 million gap between the cost of those 8 projects and the funds available to build them. We make decisions based on the information we have at the time. A hard thing for leaders to do is to pause and reconsider decisions when the conditions change." Johnson responded, "Renovation costs have also increased. A full renovation of DSA would likely cost more than $300 million, he said. Mubenga said it would take 7 years to renovate the current DSA buildings if the students remained on site, saying, "We got to a point where we have to really proceed with DSA. If we don't do it, we're not going to have enough time to open in the 26-27 school year." Mubenga reiterated the remaining money from the 22 bond after funding those 2 projects will be allocated to renovations at Glenn and Moorhead Elementary. Renovations at Glenn are set to begin in early 2024, and our bidding on the Moorhead renovations will open this spring. Frederick Davis, Senior Executive Director of Building Services for DPS, said after the meeting, "As the market continues to change, we will also be reevaluating those decisions." two other Durham articles to read now. First, Eat Well, a Durham program that offers vouchers for fruit and vegetables, announced Monday that it was allocated $10 million in North Carolina's 2023 state budget, marking the largest investment ever made into a produce prescription initiative in the country. Eat Well will use the infusion of funds to expand its work in helping people manage and prevent chronic conditions like diabetes, obesity, and heart disease by increasing access to nutrient-dense foods. The program, a branch of the Nonprofit Reinvestment Partners, operates statewide and collaborates with insurance companies and healthcare providers to identify eligible participants. Sam Heffler, Director of Food Programs at Eat Well, says our work is really supported by a broader advocacy strategy aimed toward getting the healthcare sector to be responsible and accountable for paying for food for people in the long term. Eat Well participants receive prepaid debit cards each month to purchase $40 of fruits and vegetables from selected grocers, including Food Lion, Walmart, and Safeway. A UNC study of the program found participants typically double the amount of produce they were purchasing prior to that enrollment. Heffler says people don't just use the debit card as a substitute for the money they would have originally spent on fruits and vegetables, they buy more. Barriers to healthy food access extend beyond the amount of cash that people have on hand. Some people live in food deserts, others work long hours and have limited time and energy to cook. In efforts to address other limiting factors, Eat Well has partnered with as many grocery stores as possible, Heffler says, and allows its vouchers to be used for frozen and canned produce in addition to fresh fruits and vegetables. And there are tiers to the food as medicine model, she adds. While some organizations are focused on delivering healthy prepared meals or ingredients to people's doors, Eat Well aims to provide assistance in a way that maximizes agency and leaves room for personal preference, saying, "What we have found is that folks are actually really happy to have the choice. I think it's kind of rare to kind of just get money to go buy whatever suits you." Another very important article about SCAD. The Durham County Board of Commissioners approved most of the SCAD text amendments in a 3-1 vote on Monday, greenlighting the same set of zoning code changes that the Durham City Council passed in November. Only a small portion of SCAD's many provisions intended to remove barriers to new development will impact the built environment outside city limits, said planning staff. Residents in unincorporated areas will likely feel the effect of amendments that eliminate parking minimums and allow bigger accessory dwelling units. But SCAD's central aims of creating more opportunities for infill housing and small-scale commercial development will be largely inconsequential outside of Durham proper, according to planning staff. Around 20 people, mostly opponents, spoke during that 2-hour-long public hearing. Some argued that SCAD's projected impact on communities like Rougemont and Bahama had been downplayed and raised concerns about new developments' interference with wells and septic tanks. Other opponents took a different approach, questioning the point of approving the contentious proposal if, per planning staff, its countywide impact would be modest. Commissioner Heidi Carter pushed for the board's vote to be conducted, quote, in a unified spirit with the city, saying, if we're in favor of preserving rural Durham, we should be supportive of SCAD. We should be increasing density in the urban tier and expanding housing choices by infill rather than sprawl. Despite previously criticizing the proposal, Commissioner Wendy Jacobs said, voting this down wouldn't address most of the concerns we heard from speakers, and ultimately voted yes alongside Carter and Commission Chair Nida Alam. Vice Chair Nimishina Burns voted no. Commissioner Brenda Howerton had an excused absence. Had the board not passed SCAD, the result would have been an unprecedented fracture in the Unified Development Ordinance, which enumerates zoning regulations for both the city and the county. Our important long-form article, which I've is a final installment in a three-part investigation. It's a partnership between a journal called The Assembly and WBTV in Charlotte. We've read the first two parts, and it's about foster care and adoption, now in Durham County specifically. Christopher was nervous when he arrived at Raleigh's Pullen Park to meet his biological father for the first time. I wonder if he likes Spider-Man too, the then six-year-old told his foster dad, Ryan O'Donnell, as he pushed him on the swings. Christopher had been in foster care in Durham County for 3 years at that point in 2021 and spent the last two with O'Donnell and his wife Kelly. This article refers to Christopher by his middle name to protect his privacy. His biological father, Garnell Hill, had only recently learned his son even existed. O'Donnell saw Hill approaching the park's entrance and stopped pushing the swing. "Do you see your dad?" he asked. "That's my dad," Christopher said. He bolted across a field and into Hill's arms. They played together for 2 hours. O'Donnell saying, "It was an instant connection. I knew I was no longer the number one dad in his life." And Hill recalled, "I instantly, like at the drop of a dime, fell in love. He gave me purpose." Hill, 41, uprooted his life once he learned about Christopher, relocating from the Washington, D.C. area to North Carolina. "Being a father," he said, "meant having your presence known, being there for your child, teaching them right from wrong, and being someone he could look up to." Social workers assured him he'd have custody within a few months. Hill is still fighting to bring his son home 2 years later. On December 14th, the Durham Department of Social Services, the DSS, will ask a judge to move towards severing his parental rights, even as DSS records indicate that Christopher is struggling in what is now his fifth foster placement. He left the O'Donnell's home back in January of 2022. Hill had passed a DSS background check and has never been accused of crime, abuse, or neglect. But according to a review of confidential court records and DSS reports obtained by WBTV and the Assembly, social workers decided that he shouldn't be Christopher's father, though it's unclear why. North Carolina reunifies only 30% of children in foster care with their parents, well below the national average. And Durham County's reunification rate, 22%, is among the lowest in the state. North Carolina spends more than 13 times as much on foster care and adoption as it does to prevent family separation, according to Department of Health and Human Services data. Despite recent federal legislation prioritizing reunification and prevention, many social service agencies are steeped in a culture that prizes adoption and finding permanent placements quickly, said Matt Anderson, a former executive at the Children's Home Society, the largest nonprofit foster care agency in North Carolina. Anderson said, "Our North Star needs to be the integrity of the family. The North Star needs to be the well-being of parents, and if parents are doing well, their kids are going to do well." Hill's case shows a father's quest to get his son out of foster care and the seemingly endless obstacles placed in his path, saying, "They want me to just quit. I'm not giving up on my kid." In September 2018, District Court Judge Doretta Walker declared Christopher had been neglected, writing in a court order that his mother had, quote, a long-term substance abuse history and had occasionally left him alone. His father's whereabouts were unknown, Walker wrote, and Durham DSS unsuccessfully researched its databases to locate him. It's unclear which databases the DSS searched. Though Christopher's mother gave social workers Hill's name, no one from the department contacted him. Hill says he left North Carolina in 2014, after his girlfriend, who was pregnant at the time, told him the baby wasn't his. He didn't learn otherwise till 6 years later, when a mother told a relative about Christopher. Hill says he reached out to DSS after learning his son was in foster care. Hill had owned a D.C. area catering business before the pandemic and helped raise two boys and a girl to adulthood. He moved in with his mother in Burlington and took a paternity test in October of 2020. Social workers told Hill then he'd probably take Christopher home by the end of the year. Hill stepped into Walker's courtroom that December, expecting to get commended for stepping up to the plate, he said. Instead, I get the complete opposite. I get treated like a criminal. Walker told Hill she believed he had abandoned Christopher, and she put him through a gauntlet usually required of parents accused of abuse or neglect. Hill had to find stable housing and employment in North Carolina, meet with Christopher's therapist, attend parenting classes, and learn more about Christopher's mild autism diagnosis. O'Donnell said he had to prove he's good enough. He was in the courtroom that day and became Hill's most prominent advocate. In November of 2021, a social worker wrote in a report, quote, "It is possible and in the best interest of Christopher to be reunited with Hill within 6 months. Mr. Hill had worked to establish a bond." Christopher stayed with Hill on weekends, and the report said the DSS planned for Christopher to live with his father on a trial basis, but the department's enthusiasm soon waned. In January 2022, DSS halted Christopher's weekend visits after learning that Hill had rented a room in a Burlington boarding house. Hill had stayed with his mother while he tried to gain custody of Christopher, but her small home didn't have a bedroom for Hill and his son. The boarding house was a temporary solution, but the DSS deemed it unacceptable. A social worker then added a new demand. Hill had to drive to Durham to take a drug test within the next 2 days. Reports don't provide the department's rationale. Drug testing decisions are made case by case. Hill's test came back positive for cannabis, but subsequent tests were clean, and Hill maintained steady work in a restaurant. O'Donnell also bought a house for Hill to rent, and Hill was participating in parenting classes. Walker wrote in a court order following an October 2022 hearing, "The evidence is clear that Mr. Hill is putting in the work." In December, a court-appointed psychologist reported Hill, quote, "does not present with any symptoms that would suggest mental health or substance use disorder, and does not show any significant cognitive impairments or judgment that would impact his ability to appropriately provide a safe and developmentally appropriate environment for Christopher," according to a letter provided to WBTV and the Assembly. But Hill's case was delayed for months, and a March 2023 drug test was positive for cocaine, setting the process back again. He claimed his drink was spiked. Following positive results for cannabis and alcohol in June and July, respectively, Hill completed a voluntary substance abuse program in September. No DSS reports or court orders reviewed for this article alleged that Hill was intoxicated while caring for Christopher. An August DSS report still recommended reunification, albeit with reservations, about Hill's past marijuana use. 2 months later, the department changed its mind, announcing it wanted to put Christopher up for adoption. A report cited Hill's, quote, "inability to be truthful about his past drug use" as an explanation. It also noted Hill's, quote, "concerning statements to Christopher, among them, with me is where you need to be." Christopher's guardian, Ad Litem, appointed to represent his interests in court, also recommended adoption, arguing the process had dragged on too long. Christopher has been in care since 2018, and permanency has not been achieved. Walker scheduled a hearing for December 14. Hill said, I feel like every time I go to court, I'm on trial for doing something wrong, and I don't understand why. Why am I getting railroaded like this? Walker did not respond to a request for comment. But in the 2018 Kennedy questionnaire, Walker said she decides, quote, from the facts what's in the best interest of the child. She ran unopposed in 2022. She acknowledged that judges have broad discretion. Walker said her responsibility is, quote, to discern the truth and credibility of witnesses and the evidence presented in any given situation. This requires patience and a willingness to listen to each side present their case. The O'Donnells signed up to be foster parents after a presentation at their church. They didn't yet have kids of their own when Christopher came to live with them in Cary. In July of 2019, he was their first foster child. They were his third foster family in a year. Social workers, Ryan O'Donnell said, told them he had autism, developmental delays, and behavioral issues, was basically nonverbal, and had been kicked out of preschool. But the DSS had provided limited speech and occupational therapy and no services for autism. The O'Donnells bonded quickly with Christopher. O'Donnell said, we were there to absorb a lot of trauma for him, just to be there, to hold him till he falls asleep. Socially, emotionally, he's just been through so much. With a new preschool and a stable home life, Christopher improved. A month later, a social worker told the O'Donnells if they wanted to adopt him, the department would seek to terminate his mother's parental rights. O'Donnell said he was warned, family will come out of the woodwork when we do this. We'll handle them for you. But DSS didn't file for parental termination. The pandemic set the world into lockdown, and Christopher's behavior regressed. O'Donnell said he and his wife felt overwhelmed. By the time Hill emerged that summer, they were starting to wonder how long they could care for Christopher. Initially, DSS told the O'Donnells that as a non-offending parent, Hill could likely take Christopher home within months. But months became a year, and the couple grew increasingly frustrated with social workers' resistance to letting Hill raise his son. In their view, Hill had done everything the department asked, and Christopher kept saying he wanted to live with his dad. O'Donnell says, what more do you expect from him? We kept pressing this. I felt like a broken record. Meanwhile, social workers had loaded Christopher's schedule with mandatory weekly meetings and appointments, and by January 2022, the O'Donnells had reached a breaking point. O'Donnell said, we finally put our foot down. He's only really with us for maybe an hour and a half a night. We're like, y'all need to take a look at what you're expecting from him because this kid is exhausted. They told DSS they were done and suggested they try to place Christopher with Hill's mother. But Walker declared in a court order that Hill's mother's house was unsuitable for Christopher because a ditch in the backyard might be dangerous after a rainstorm. O'Donnell said his own house had a pond in the backyard. So DSS moved Christopher to another foster home instead. When he was a student at North Carolina School of Science and Math in 2011, O'Donnell helped organize a food drive that still holds a Guinness World Record for largest 24-hour food drive, collecting nearly 500,000 pounds of food. Now a tech entrepreneur, O'Donnell said he's always wanted to attack the root issues of a problem. After fostering Christopher, he applied his skills to the child welfare system, which was still, quote, a world of fax machines and snail mail. He created a website that aggregates public data and people's experiences with social service agencies and launched an app to assist parents like Hill as they navigate court dates, meetings, and appointments. O'Donnell said no one's really helping parents. No one's building things for them. There's very little investment. O'Donnell says the home he bought for Hill to rent illustrates this dynamic and provides a model that social services agencies could emulate. Durham's DSS was prepared to terminate Hill's rights because he didn't have adequate housing. Hill wasn't looking for a handout, said O'Donnell, but he couldn't afford the type of place DSS would actually approve. Hill pays $700 a month in rent. Critics say that despite a federal law that prioritizes keeping families together, the child welfare system subjects parents to scrutiny rather than finding ways to assist those in difficult circumstances. Anderson, that former Children's Home Society executive, says, "This is one of the fundamental flaws that we've not come to grips with yet in the child welfare system. We're intervening in the lives of families every single day that face challenges they need help to deal with, and instead, they're getting mandated requirements placed on them. If they don't comply with, the court system's going to turn against them, and they may never get their kids back." Last year, Anderson left to found Proximity Design Studio, a media production and consulting firm that works to keep families together. Reform advocates point out the federal government spends $8.4 billion a year on foster care and adoption, but only about $700 million on programs that prevent families from being separated. In the most recent fiscal year, North Carolina spent about $450 million per year on foster care and adoption, $450 million, and $34 million on prevention. DHHS Health and Human Services spokesperson Kelly Haight noted, "North Carolina has historically had one of the country's worst funded child welfare systems, though this year's state budget makes key investments in behavioral health and initiatives to improve outcomes for children in foster care." She said the department, quote, "makes every effort to ensure that children and families have the services they need to keep their children at home safely and reduce entry into foster care." Also, she said that DHHS supported a reform package that unanimously passed the Senate earlier this year. Among other things, the legislation would give DHHS greater oversight of county social service departments, require DSS attorneys to undergo training in child welfare law, make it easier for fathers like Hill who didn't know about their kids to seek custody, and tighten some criteria for terminating parental rights. State Senator Sidney Batch, a Wake County Democrat who co-sponsored the bill, says she wants to shift the child welfare paradigm. Batch, a lawyer who has represented parents in child welfare cases for almost two decades, says, "You can prioritize safety without eliminating parental rights. They're not mutually exclusive. You're actually doing more harm than good by creating legal orphans by terminating rights instead of putting services in place that would prevent people from being in that situation." The state house had different ideas. In May, it passed a bill on nearly party-line vote requiring courts to terminate parental rights more quickly and in more circumstances. Neither chamber considered the other's bill this year. While statewide changes appeared stalled, critics say local social service departments can make meaningful reforms. A decade ago, Mecklenburg County's child welfare system focused on support rather than surveillance, says a 2021 report from the Annie E. Casey Foundation. Between 2014 and 2019, Mecklenburg cut the number of children entering foster care nearly in half, according to the report, and DHHS records show that Mecklenburg's 40% reunification is almost double Durham's. Anderson said their leadership set a vision around, "We're going to support families, we're going to keep families together. That's going to be our priority. That's going to change the culture over time, and that's going to change outcomes." Recent DSS reports say Christopher, now in his fifth foster home, is, quote, regressing without a clear cause and was hospitalized in August following a mental health crisis. DSS wouldn't let Hill see him. Social workers said Christopher, who turned 9 on Halloween, is upset that he couldn't be good long enough to go home and questioned why it's taken so long to be reunited with Hill. The two are currently allowed supervised visit for 1 hour a week. At a December 14th hearing, that was yesterday, Walker will decide whether to accept DSS recommendation to move Christopher toward adoption. On that day, Christopher will have been in DSS custody for 1,978 days. And for more than half that time, his father has been trying to take him home. Hill won't go into the courtroom alone. Since WBTV and the Assembly began publishing this series, the Durham-based Operation Stop CPS has started advocating on Hill's behalf, rallying supporters on Instagram to pack the court by arguing that, quote, the family policing system in Durham has villainized and criminalized this black father. Walker seems unlikely to appreciate this scrutiny. She previously imposed a gag order, blocking Operation Stop CPS founder Amanda Wallace from discussing a different case, and has ejected legal observers from her courtroom. But Hill says he needs all the support he can get, saying, I just can't imagine they give him up for adoption. I know God's got a plan for everybody, and I think we're going to be reunited. I can't think any other way. All right, our broadcast of Indie Week now heads over to Chapel Hill and Michigan, the state of Michigan. Michigan State University announced that UNC Chapel Hill Chancellor Kevin Guskiewicz will become its next president during a Friday morning meeting of that university's Board of Trustees. The board unanimously approved Guskiewicz's hire with a starting date of March 4th. His last day at Chapel Hill will be January the 12th. Trustees at Michigan State praised Guskiewicz's leadership at UNC and said they have high hopes for him as their university's 22nd president. The revelation that Guskiewicz had applied for the presidency at MSU took faculty members, students, alumni, and even the Board of Trustees by surprise. His name was leaked as one of two finalists in a search process MSU trustees have described as compromised and botched. The other finalist, University of Texas at San Antonio President Taylor Eichmann, dropped out after that leak. Some faculty members and trustees told Newsline this week the leak was embarrassing, particularly in light of ongoing feuding on the politically elected Board of Trustees and years of high-profile scandals at the university. Guskiewicz said to trustees at Friday's meeting, I'm aware that MSU has had faced more than its share of challenges in recent years, yet I see a strong diversity with an inspiring historical foundation that can reach new levels of excellence through its powerful commitment to student success, knowledge, and land-grant service. Guskiewicz was received enthusiastically by MSU trustees and members of its presidential search committee Friday, including representatives of the student body and faculty. I pursued this opportunity, said Guskiewicz in a video, because I believe my values and vision align well with those of Michigan State, and I share and admire your deep commitment to transforming lives through the power of teaching, research, and outreach. Members of UNC Chapel Hill's Board of Trustees told Newsline Friday that their first communication from Guskiewicz on his decision came in the form of an email moments after the MSU announcement had been made public. Michigan State trustees praised Guskiewicz's record of leadership, highlighting his connections to and communication with faculty at UNC and students, and his commitment on diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI. Vassar said at Friday's meeting, to name just a couple of his accomplishments, Dr. Guskowitz appointed a special commission to examine UNC's 230-year history with race and racism, recommending ways to redress harm and more move communities forward. Before that, he launched the first ever Faculty Diversity Advisory Committee. DEI efforts are just one area in which Guskowitz butted heads with the UNC Chapel Hill's Board of Trustees, the UNC System Board of Governors, and the Republican majority on the North Carolina General Assembly. In April, the General Assembly's Joint Legislative Commission on Government Operation required the UNC system and its 17 campuses to provide information on all DEI and accessibility training programs they employ. The request included a lengthy list of terms to define DEI that reads like a roundup of recent obsessions of conservative activists. Diversity, equity, inclusion, accessibility, racism, anti-racist, oppression, internalized oppression, systemic racism, sexism, gender, LGBTQ+, white supremacy, unconscious bias, microaggressions, critical race theory, intersectionality, or social justice. The move, part of a national wave of anti-DEI moves in Republican-led states, is one of many items that faculty, students, and alumni have highlighted in voicing concerns that conservative politics are increasingly intruding upon how universities operate. Governor Roy Cooper took to Twitter, X, Thursday to weigh in on Guskowitz's possible departure, its causes, and concerns the search for his successor will be politicized. Cooper wrote, as the nation's leading public university, UNC attracts worldwide leaders to the office of chancellor, but meddling from legislative appointees is driving them away. Because the GOP legislature seized university trustee appointments and installed hard right appointees on the Board of Governors, our reputation is beginning to suffer. A change to add diversity of opinion and more respect for higher education is needed in university governance, and the answer is in the Governor's Commission on the Governance of Public Universities, Cooper wrote. He'd created that bipartisan commission last year by executive order. Republican leadership in the legislature, which appoints members to the Board of Governors and the campus-level boards of trustees, dismissed the commission and its conclusion before it had held its first meeting. Carol Folt, now president of the University of Southern California, was the chancellor Guskowitz followed at UNC Chapel Hill. In a Michigan State press release, Folt praised Guskowitz, saying, I've known Kevin for more than a decade. He's one of the most talented, visionary, and ethical leaders in all of higher education. He leads with compassion, decisiveness, and integrity. He builds consensus across differences. He lives opportunity and equity every day, and he puts students at the center. He's always looking for bold ideas to build the future, and the community will love working with him. As a proud Midwesterner myself, whose own career was launched as a postdoc at MSU, I'm so excited for Kevin, MSU, and the people of Michigan. There was no immediate announcement of an interim chancellor from the system on Friday at UNC. President Peter Hans will make that selection in the next week or so before forming a search committee to find the university's next permanent leader, a system spokesperson told Newsline. Hans, in a written statement, said Chancellor Guskowitz has led UNC Chapel Hill with grace and goodwill through some very difficult moments, and he's leaving the university in stronger shape than when he arrived. I join faculty, staff, and students and alumni at Carolina in deep appreciation for his leadership. Kevin is a brilliant researcher, a kind colleague, and a mentor to many young people. The Guskowitz family have been good friends to me, and I know Kevin and Amy will remain devoted Tar Heels. Since Guskowitz's possible exit was first reported last month, much attention has been focused on a possible successor. The committee Hunts appoints will include representatives from the student body and faculty and will be tasked with recommending candidates for the position. The University Board of Trustees will then send Hunts an unranked slate of at least three finalists, from which he will choose one to present to the Board of Governors for a vote. UNC Chapel Hill trustees and members of the Board of Governors tell Newsline they've heard persistent rumors the interim might be a UNC Chapel Hill provost, Chris Clemens, a Chapel Hill trustee, Malcolm Turner, or a UNC Board of Governors member, Lee Roberts. Any member of the Board of Trustees or Governors would have to resign their seat in order to become chancellor, either on an interim or permanent basis. As of Friday morning, no member had yet resigned. Members of both governing boards told Newsline they dismiss rumors that Hunts has already decided on the permanent chancellor before the search committee has undertaken its work. Faculty members, students, and alumni are already questioning whether Roberts, who has no administrative experience in higher education, but is politically well-connected as a one-time budget director for former Republican Governor Pat McCrory, will be chosen simply because his politics align best with the Republican-dominated legislature and its political appointees on governing boards. A member of the Board of Governors told Newsline this week, "I think it's way too early for anyone to be saying a decision has been made, and I can tell you I haven't been part of any discussions about this yet." Next, from Wake County and the Raleigh area, construction is starting on the bus rapid transit line along New Bern Avenue, but some Raleigh residents worry it will do more harm than good. Stepping up to the podium to talk to Raleigh City Council members, lifelong resident Octavia Rainey is visibly angry. "I'm here to talk about the TOD, that's the Transit Overlay District," she says, snapping out every syllable. "As I look at New Bern Avenue, I am not happy. You have no right to change our zoning. Y'all did a great job of removing the blacks from downtown in 1986, Rainey adds scornfully. "The footprint of downtown should not be on New Bern Avenue." In a month-long campaign, Rainey attended that October 17th meeting to talk about the city council's plan to redevelop more than 700 acres of land along New Bern Avenue. That's a major roadway through southeast Raleigh. She and others are worried the proposed zoning changes, which would allow taller buildings, more apartments and townhomes, and discourage driving, will worsen gentrification in the historically African-American community. The issue is deeply personal to Rainey, who has lived in the College Park neighborhood almost her entire life. She's been talking about issues of gentrification and public transport in Raleigh since at least 2007. "I love New Bern Avenue," Rainey tells Indy. "That is my beloved community. And when it comes to my beloved community, you're going to hear my voice." The argument over whether to enact zoning changes along New Bern, which has played out in neighborhood and city meetings for more than a year, started with a bus line. In 2016, Raleigh and Wake County officials proposed investing in bus rapid transit, BRT, a new bus system that would operate like the subway, giving people regular, convenient access to downtown Raleigh. At the time, residents demanded that southeast Raleigh be prioritized over other locations, says Mayor Pro Tem Corey Branch, who was involved in the planning process and represents District C, where New Bern BRT is now being built. Branch says, "The community back then was always saying, why are we always last to get things done? Why do things have to happen to other communities and then you come to southeast Raleigh?" In light of those sentiments, City Council members decided to start their rollout of BRT on New Bern. In an effort to ensure the success of the bus system and secure federal funding, the City Council also proposed a set of zoning changes, dubbed the Transit Overlay District, TOD. These changes, they said, would encourage denser development along those bus routes and increase ridership. Today, however, some critics argue that the proposed rezoning will also encourage developers to build bigger and more expensive housing, leading to the displacement of longtime black residents and the disappearance of black-owned businesses. Russ Stevenson, former city council member and planning commissioner, said during a planning commission of the whole meeting last month, "What I've heard today are all the reasons this is going to promote economic development. I haven't heard anything that said, this is how these are going to serve the lowest wealth communities, or here's how we're going to protect those families from displacement. I'm very concerned that everything here is framed around growth and development and all the promises we made to the community back in 2016 seem to be missing. The proposed zoning changes encompassed in cases Z9222 and CP722 are expected to come before the City Council on January 30th next year, when a massive and complex conversation about gentrification, housing equality, and black neighborhoods will likely continue. For Charles Thomas, a Charlotte philanthropist working for the Knight Foundation, investment in black neighborhoods starts with talking to the community. In longtime African-American communities like Raleigh's Battery Heights, which government officials have historically neglected, there's a lot of distrust, Thomas says. You're going to have people who just think any kind of investment is bad because of gentrification. But don't all communities deserve certain amenities? It's a very fine line. So that's why trust is critical. Otherwise, people feel rolled over. Thomas has watched many skilled community engagement professionals retreat in the face of harsh criticism from residents, but, quote, it's not personal, it's historical, he says. That distrust is clearly on display with activists like Rainey. She argues the BRT and proposed zoning changes will destroy black neighborhoods. For years, she's tried to get city council members to invest in the area, only to be met with denials or empty promises. The city didn't meet us halfway on nothing, she says. They came in with change in mind. She cites one provision of the TOD that might remove some working-class business from New Bern Avenue, businesses that already employ and serve residents. The provision prohibits land around the transit corridor for being used for drive-throughs, like the one at existing Bojangles and Cookout locations, major vehicle repair business, gas stations, and other uses that are, quote, incompatible with high levels of transit service. Rainey says, the reason why I talk about gentrification and how the city wipes out black neighborhoods goes back to the Raleigh Redevelopment Commission back in the 1940s, referring to a time when city officials openly attempted to oust black residents from certain areas of Raleigh. The city hasn't changed at all. In Charlotte, Thomas says the Knight Foundation is focused on including residents in conversations about development. The nonprofit helped fund the 5 Points Forward plan, a vision for the city's West End, developed in part by residents. The Knight Foundation also gives money to local community groups that are already doing work to improve their neighborhoods. Thomas saying, the idea is that providing resources to residents to influence development, they'll be the best ones to guide it towards benefiting the historic black community. We fund resident-based organizations who have started economic development groups that are doing small business attraction and retention. They're brokering deals. They're getting control of land. And they are actually the group leading the planning effort as well. Gentrification is already underway along New Bern Avenue. According to Bynum Walker, Raleigh's assistant director for planning and development, since 2000, property values and housing costs along New Bern Avenue have increased. Walker reported during a city council workshop, developers are tearing down older homes to build bigger and more expensive ones, and the supply of housing is increasing only incrementally, she added. If we just leave things to the existing market and zoning, the result is just going to be more of the same, Walter bluntly told the city council. We can expect to see these same patterns of an increasingly white population with higher household incomes, increasing housing prices. Doing nothing is probably the least equitable choice that we have. Making the proposed zoning changes, which include incentives for developers to build below market rate housing, quote, will create a different outcome from what we have been seeing in the New Bern corridor over the last 10 years, Walter argues. The city's plan to help support the black community also includes dozens of government-funded programs designed to build more affordable housing, help people buy homes for the first time, and prevent the displacement of existing residents and black-owned business. So far, the city has invested more than $2 million in this work, funding local nonprofits like Southeast Raleigh Promise and El Centro Hispano, in addition to its own programs. City money has also led to the construction of 200 units of affordable housing along New Bern Avenue, with 672 more to come. The city is also in the process of purchasing both a nearby gas station and the old DMV headquarters in an effort to bank land for affordable housing or other public projects. In the meantime, city staff are working on a plan to increase assistance for low-income renters in the area, which city council members agree will be key. Research has shown that the way local officials plan for development around transit can make a difference. In Portland, Oregon, for example, neighborhoods near light rail stations experienced counter-gentrification due to more residents with high transit needs being able to occupy station areas, according to a study made in 2017. Some, however, are still worried that the city is not doing enough to ensure a good outcome for people who live along New Bern Avenue. Reeves Peeler, a longtime activist, now a member of the city's planning commission, says, "Since we know gentrification is happening already, we've got to take extra care to not further that problem. How do you keep people in this corridor that currently rely on the bus? That should be the underlying point of what we're trying to do." He says the city should be more serious about acquiring land in the corridor. He, like Knight, also supports the creation of a community land trust, which guarantees some housing remains permanently affordable. In addition, Peeler says the city should be more aggressive in preserving naturally occurring affordable housing and disincentivizing the construction of luxury apartments. Ultimately, he's also skeptical that some of the policies included in the TOD will work to produce enough affordable housing and other community benefits. Quote, "As it currently stands, I don't support a TOD being put in New Bern." One controversial provision in this TOD is the density bonus, which allows developers to build taller buildings if they include below-market-rate housing. The bonus kicks in if developers plan to construct buildings above 4, 5, 7, or in some areas, 12 stories. Peeler, however, is doubtful there's a demand for buildings over 4 stories, he says, which is going to guarantee we get no density bonus. Rainey, similarly, worries the density bonus won't serve the people most in need of affordable housing. That bonus encourages developers to build units affordable to people making at or below 60% of the area median income, which in Raleigh is about $48,000 for one person, $68,000 for a family of four. "The whole thing needs to be at or below 30%, says Rainey. She also wants the city to consider building a mental health center in the corridor, as well as single-room occupancy housing, which could serve low-income workers and payrollees. Water, Walters. The city's assistant director for planning and development argues that the density bonus is based on market research and that these kinds of incentives have been successful elsewhere in Raleigh, on Hillsborough Street, Glenwood Avenue, north of the Beltline. Walters says projects along these transit corridors include affordable housing, and they take advantage of the city's frequent transit development option. The requirements of that option and TOD are pretty similar, says Walter, so the fact the market is interested in this suggests to me the math of the TOD bonus is likely to be appealing to the development market. For one affordable housing developer who's building 192 units of rental housing at 3600 New Bern Avenue, the FTDO allowed them to move forward without a rezoning. So their project cost is less, said Walter. Everything we can do to bring down project costs for affordable housing is, that's always the goal. The other projects, she adds, are being built by private developers without a financial contribution from the city of Raleigh, freeing up money for even more affordable housing. Ultimately, Walter believes the BRT will benefit New Bern Avenue community because the density bonus isn't the only tool city staff are using to try and create equitable development. The BRT is not just a construction project, she says. There are all these other components that work together so that as many people as possible, especially existing residents and business, will benefit from that infrastructure investment. The whole is greater than the sum of the parts, she adds. To me, that's why it's going to work, because there is no silver bullet that we're relying on here. Well, there are those people down in the front yard on my lawn playing music, telling me I must stop reading articles now. And I've had to put aside some musical articles and an article which I will save, hopefully for next week, about a Paralympic swimmer, Morgan Stickney. And so John Federson will now say farewell. This broadcast of Indie Week is going to be aired on Friday afternoon, and then afterwards it will be available as a podcast, as a regular program, a huge collection of Indie Week, so you can see what we thought back in 1973. So, John Federson again. Goodbye for the NC Reading Service.com.